Today, it's called Geometry of the Hilbert Space and Quantum Phase Transitions. Okay? So we will realize our program of giving a geometric way of describing the manifold of quantum states that are associated in some way to a Hamiltonian, motivated by the fact that we want to have a definition of a phase that is not based just on symmetry, but it is a more general concept of states, you know, they are in the same equivalence class if the distance between them behaves in some smooth way. Okay, so this is what our premise. So we start with a manifold M. So a point lambda here will have coordinates lambda 1, lambda n. And to each point, we associate a quantum state psi of lambda. And this association can be made in whatever way you want. And for a great part of this lecture, this will be left free, so we will not commit to anything. But what we have in mind is that we will do it in this way eventually, that lambda gives us a Hamiltonian H of lambda. Then we diagonalize it, and we find the ground state of this Hamiltonian. So this manifold is the manifold of the ground states of a smooth family of Hamiltonians, smooth in a lambda. Okay? But only at the end of the lecture, we will use the fact that it comes from a Hamiltonian. You might have some other procedure that associates to lambda a state, a quantum state psi of lambda. You know, then on a manifold, you can do the usual things. You can draw curves. You can have an infinitesimal displacement. So for instance, you wonder, what is the distance when you transform, when you move from your state from psi of lambda to psi of lambda plus delta lambda? And yesterday, we found out what is the distance, the infinitesimal distance between these two states. It's the so-called Fubini's 2D metric. And we said this is the arccosine of the fidelity, where the fidelity is the modulus of the overlap between these two states. You remember we found this thing by really inquiring about the distinguishability of a quantum state. So we had really an operational meaning, because this is like the trace distance, which is, oh, what is the optimal measurement that distinguishes quantum states. And so if states are nearby, so this is almost one, this quantity can be developed like the square root of 1 minus f squared. Good. So you see that in order to understand what is this distance, we need to compute f squared. So what will f squared be? It's the square of this quantity, which, let me be boring, let me just write it like this. Right? Because this is the modulus square. Okay. So now what I could do is to do this product. And to do this product, I would like to develop psi of lambda plus delta lambda in a Taylor expansion. Right? So you write it as psi lambda plus the first derivative of psi times delta lambda and so on and so forth. So you have some long, tedious expression that you will have to compute. And it will become something. So let me introduce now some definitions, and we see what it becomes. So first of all, OK, so let me write it here. Define these quantities, beta mu is, as a function of lambda, is minus I, the inner product between psi of lambda and the derivative of psi of lambda with respect to the parameter lambda mu. OK? Is this definition clear? And then let me define this other object with the two indices. It's the inner product of the derivative of the state along the direction mu and the derivative of the state along the direction nu. Okay. Now let me define a very simple combination of these two objects. That is, I call it q mu nu, which is equal to gamma mu nu minus beta mu beta nu. This object is called quantum geometric tensor. And it is the combination of these two objects. And because of that, this is a complex object, right? It's not necessarily a real object. As a homework, prove that the complexity comes from this term. The betas are real. So try to imagine. In fact, the proof of proving something like this is real is something that is used all the time in quantum mechanics in other contexts. But overall, this is a complex object. So it makes sense to take the real and the imaginary part. And the real part of q mu nu is called the g mu nu. So it's real. And just because in order to take the real part, you have to basically what you have to do is q mu nu, it is gamma mu nu plus gamma nu mu, then it's symmetric. And you can show that it's a positive definite. In other words, this is a Riemannian tensor. It is worthwhile also to ask what is the imaginary part of q mu nu. And this is I, the derivative of beta nu minus the nu beta mu. And this is a bit like an electric field, right? With this as a connection, that is like the potential. and we call it F mu nu, because it's a bit like an electric field. This is called adiabatic curvature. So this object, defined in this way, gives rise to two different geometric objects. One is a Riemannian tensor, whereas the imaginary part is an adiabatic curvature. I call it adiabatic because this object is a connection, it's so-called the Berry connection. It's the object that you integrate to find the Berry face. Maybe some of you can recognize it. Okay, so these are definitions. And what is the connection between these objects and all of this? The connection is the following. If I take the square of the Fubini study metric, so what in differential geometry is the ds square, right? The square of the line element. So if you compute this in the Taylor expansion and you compare it with these definitions, you find that this is equal to g mu nu d lambda mu delta lambda nu. So this is the first result that we wanted. And it is saying that the Riemannian tensor that is defined in this way is a valid Riemannian tensor, and therefore it defines a distance on the space of quantum states that depend in a way that you can differentiate from a parameter, a set of parameters lambda. And this has been known by mathematicians for a long time, I think at least from the 80s. We added an interpretation that this distance is the statistical distance between quantum states, corresponds to how distinguishable they are by experiments. Okay. So now what is the connection of all these things with our quantum phase transitions and ground states of local Hamiltonians? Okay. So far as you can see, the Hamiltonian didn't play any role. This psi of lambda are generic quantum states that depend smoothly to a on a parameter lambda. There is no Hamiltonian or ground state thing here. So now we use it. Okay? So from now on, this state psi lambda is a psi zero lambda, which is ground state of H of lambda, which is the Hamiltonian of a quantum many-body system. Also bear in mind that we know it's local in the sense it's the sum of local operators. Okay, so let's use this. And we wonder what is, you see, the ingredients that we need to compute the quantum geometric tensor are the derivatives, the overlaps between the state and the derivatives of the state with respect to lambda, or the overlaps between these derivatives of the state. So because we need to find what is the derivative of the state, well, this means we need to understand what is this. Because then we do the same thing. The derivative is this minus the state at lambda over delta lambda. Right, that's the derivative. So we need to understand what is this. And how do we know now what is the state, the ground state for lambda plus delta lambda, if we know this? How do we find out? So in general, we don't know, right? Because we have not specified how we define this family. But now this is the ground state of this Hamiltonian. So now we know how to find it. Because we have specified the protocol by which we obtain this state. So what is that we could do? So you know the Hamiltonian as a function of your parameters. You know the state at lambda. You want to know how it changes at lambda plus delta lambda. What is this? What state is this? Is the ground state of what?
Excited state.
Huh?
Excited state.
This is an excited state of this Hamiltonian, right? But it is also a ground state. It's a ground state of another Hamiltonian. This is the ground state of this Hamiltonian. Right? Remember, this is how we built our manifold. For every lambda, we have an H lambda. We diagonalize it, and we find its ground state. So this state is the ground state of this Hamiltonian. So this is the Hamiltonian that has been changed a little bit. So what Hamiltonian is it? This is H lambda plus this. Do you agree? And what is this operator with respect to this operator? So this is small. What is this? It's a perturbation. Very good. So finding the ground state of this Hamiltonian is tantamount to finding the ground state of this Hamiltonian, which is a perturbation of the old Hamiltonian. So we can just use perturbation theory, right? So let's use perturbation theory and write this as the initial state. So the ground state of the unperturbed Hamiltonian plus what comes from perturbation theory. And how do we do perturbation theory? We try to understand what is the overlap at every order of the rest of the state in the excited states of the initial Hamiltonian, right? Because that is a basis. So you sum over all the states that are the excited states of H of lambda, see, not the ground state, and then you have just the expectation value, everything here depends on lambda, of this object. The excited state, and here we have the gap between the n excited state and the ground state. So now you see that what is, maybe you can tell me, since now I know what is this with respect to all this, then what is what we call the mu psi of lambda. What will it be? So this is the derivative, means is this minus this divided by delta lambda in the direction mu, where I left all the other directions the same. So the only thing that survives is this object without this, right? So this is so now this is perturbation theory at the first order, so I should put other orders. Okay. So this is an approximation. This is an approximation. However, what about this? Is this an approximation or this is exact?
Exact.
Why it's exact?
So the second order is order delta lambda.
Yes. Because it's the derivative. So first order fancy way of saying that. First order perturbation theory on the tangent space is exact because the tangent space is the space of the derivatives. Yes?
You're also assuming that the ground state is non-degenerate, right?
Yes. Yes, in this treatment we are assuming that this is non-degenerate. If you have a degenerate ground state, then you have to use degenerate perturbation theory. So this means that you still have to diagonalize the same operator in this space. And you know, you just it becomes a bit of, as usual, like in degenerate perturbation theory, it's mostly an exercise in notation. You have to put another index alpha so that you know where you are inside these subspaces. And so I'm doing this for the sake, in this simple way for the sake of simplicity. But yes. Okay. So we have this very neat expression. And now you see that for these states, for the ground states, the beta are identically zero. Why they're identically zero? Because the beta are the overlap between this object and the ground state. But this object is an expansion only on the excited states, so they're orthogonal. Good. So we are only left, in order to compute our geometric tensor, we just need to compute that overlap, delta mu, delta nu. Okay, so now this is really easy, but it's just long to write the whole calculation. You realize that this just becomes something that is a bit like the square of this object. So this becomes, so let me copy the expression. So the sum of n different from zero. Now I have my gap squared. And now I have just psi zero delta mu h psi n delta nu h psi 0. Yes. So this is my quantum geometric tensor. So let's do some remarks. So the real part of this, which is just q mu nu plus q nu mu, is our Riemannian tensor. And look what it contains. It contains something that is like the probability that the perturbation, the mu h, which is what happens when I change my Hamiltonian in the mu direction, makes me tunnel from my ground state to the n excited state. And this is one instead in the new direction. And this is weighed by the gap. So if there is a large gap between 0 and the n, it is more difficult to tunnel. Otherwise, it's more probable. and then you sum over all the possible channels. So this is a sort of the probability of transitioning out of your ground state and getting the excited states. So now you immediately see that in the more general case of, okay, now we do not have symmetry. This means that generally we do not want to interpret a quantum phase transition as the fact that we have a change of degeneracy. We don't know, right? We want a general theory of how quantum phase transitions happen that does only depends on the distinguishability of the states. So our guiding principle that the quantum phase transition should happen in a gapless point that is tied to symmetry breaking, in general now we don't know. However, we see a hint that possibly if one of these gaps goes to zero, this thing might diverge. Might diverge, right? Because it depends also on the numerator. Okay, so we are going to explore this in detail. Oh, this is the bottom one. Okay, so let me go here. Okay, so application of this to a known model. The XY model that yesterday you played with and found hopefully everything about it, right? So we know how to diagonalize it. So let me write the Hamiltonian again. Now I write it in this form. So I have two parameters, lambda and gamma. This is a spin chain minus between minus m and m. So I have 2m plus 1 spins. 1 plus gamma over 2, sigma x I plus 1, plus 1 minus gamma over 2, sigma y I plus 1, and the transverse field lambda. Okay. And now we have learned by the diagonalization with Jordan Wigner that the ground states are a family parameterized by lambda gamma in this form. Let me write lambda gamma in the form of this angle theta, because remember, these angles theta, when we diagonalize these models, are some complicated expression of lambda and gamma. So this is the tensor product of fermions k and minus k. And we have our BCS form of Cooper pairs, or particles and antiparticles, depends what you prefer. Now you see also because we so much love disintegrable models that become free fermions, because since now what we want to write are overlaps between the derivatives of these objects, now it's very easy to take the derivative of this object with respect to lambda and gamma, that are you just need to take the derivatives of these guys, and then you do it k by k, and then you do the inner product. So this is one of your homeworks. It's a homework or a tutorial, Laura?
Homework.
Homework, yes.
Homework.
Okay. So if you do it, so you do the overlap between psi 0 for a certain value of theta and psi 0 for an... So this is like theta, and this theta bar is theta plus delta theta. So you get a very neat closed expression, which is the product of cosines. In this way. And because this is the central ingredient because it is the fidelity, right, is f. The modulus of that is f. So it is what we need to find the quantum geometric tensor. So if you plug it in, after a little algebra, we find that the real part of Q mu nu, which is what we call G mu nu, is 1/4 the sum over all the fermions of these derivatives. So we have a very closed expression for this thing. And possibly the only thing that we do not like is that this is a sum with many terms, right? So it depends. I would have so many derivatives with one by one. If I have a chain with 200 spins, I would have to sum over all of them. OK, but that's why we like the thermodynamic limit. So we send m to infinity. And so this is a trick that is used all the time. This sum becomes n is 2m plus 1. Okay, so this is a usual trick in taking the thermodynamic limit. Oh, now it's great because I just need to integrate this expression where now k, you consider it a continuous index x. Remember that k is labeled by some objects, is quantized, and it's divided by n, so it becomes a continuous index. So you do the integral, and you find, for instance, let me write it just for lambda, because you find different expressions when the modulus of lambda is smaller than 1 or greater than 1. Let me write this one. In the notes, you will find also the other one. So this is a 2x2 matrix, right? Because this is the space of our parameters. Mu and nu take only the values lambda and gamma. These are our two directions on our manifold. And this is the Riemannian tensor. It's also diagonal. And now we see something, that this guy diverges when gamma is 0. And also diverges with when lambda is 1. So I don't know if you remember the phase diagram of the XY model. So for lambda, so this is lambda equal minus 1, this is lambda equal plus 1. All this line at gamma equal 0 is a line of criticality. And also lambda equal 1 and lambda equal minus 1 are lines of criticality. I think this is called xy criticality. This is called xx criticality. Why it's called xx criticality? Because gamma equal 0 means the coupling. Gamma is the anisotropy in the coupling between xx and yy. So when gamma is equal 0, we call the model xx, means the coupling in the y direction is the same than in the x direction. So this is called xx criticality. And OK, so we see this part of the phase diagram by this. Another thing that one could do, since we have a Riemannian tensor, is to compute curvature. So So to compute curvature, you remember you have a certain number of derivatives of the metric tensor to take. And I will just contend to show you the Ricci scalar. Now I show you the two expressions for, this is for lambda strictly smaller than one. So we have this number. And for lambda greater than one, we have this other number. So you see that at lambda equal one, if you connect these two formulae, going to lambda one from the left and going from lambda one from the right, there is a discontinuity. So the Ricci scalar has a discontinuity at lambda equal one, which is therefore a critical point, or all, and lambda minus one. So in this application, we see that our definitions make sense in a known model of which we already know the phase diagram as defined by symmetry. But this is much more general. Okay. So now we can answer the question. I will have. So please have in mind this formula because I'm going to use it in a moment, but unfortunately I have to cover it. So now we want to ask the general question. For a general theory, is it true that gaplessness is an indicator of a quantum phase transition? And this is regardless of the fact that we have symmetry breaking, in which it is, because only when you become gapless, then you can change it, you can break the symmetry and the degenerate ground state. Okay? But in general, so we go beyond that paradigm. Is it true that gaplessness is important? Which seems to be suggested by that expression that I just covered, right? Because it's at the denominator. But well, it depends, right? Because you have these terms at the numerator, so we need to say something more precise than that. Okay, so this is what I'm going to do now. So let's start with our G mu nu. So remember, G mu nu is that expression, is the real part of Q mu nu, and Q mu nu is that expression that I covered. Okay? So for every mu, for every choice of mu and nu, that is an operator that acts in the Hilbert space, right? But now I'm asking you to consider G mu nu, to forget that for every choice of mu nu, it's an operator in the Hilbert space. And I'm just asking you to look at it as a matrix in the mu nu space, okay? It's a symmetric matrix, like the one that I wrote here. So this is a symmetric matrix. I can diagonalize it. And let phi I be its eigenvectors. Among these eigenvectors, there is one that is the eigenvector of maximum eigenvalue. And if you remember, that eigenvalue is also the operator norm, you know, the matrix norm of this object. So let this be the so-called max eigenvector. Okay. So obviously, these matrix elements in absolute value are upper bounded by this expectation value. Right? Because phi is the eigenstate of maximum eigenvalue. Now, I would like to expand phi, this maximum eigenvector, in a generic basis in this space mu nu. Okay? Not in the basis of the eigenvectors of G mu nu, in a general basis. So this is a general basis in my vector space that is the vector space tangent to our manifold. And these are the coefficients of this vector in this space. Okay. Now let me define this object, delta H. So this is a definition. Is the mu H times this coefficient, and then I sum over mu. Okay, so I'm using Einstein convention, but let me put it explicitly. Now, remember that, let me pull this up for a second, that this the mu H is the object that is here, and that somehow I'm not really taking the expectation value of it, but, you know, I am sandwiching it in some way. Okay, let's see what happens. Notice that I could define a vector, then mu h, by simply using these coefficients and using them as coefficients for an expansion in this basis. Right? That's just the definition. Therefore, this is like the inner product between these two guys. Okay, so now let's put together the things. So now remember our expression for G mu nu, which is what is covered in here. And it's the real part of that, but I'm taking modulus, absolute values. So it's just the symmetrized of this. So this will be smaller than the sum over all the excited states. And now I have the gap to the minus 2, right? It was at the denominator. And then I have psi 0, psi n, and psi n, psi 0. So this is the modulus square, psi 0. And here I have this object. And why this is true? Because, see, here I'm in that expression, I'm looking at the derivative of H in the direction mu and nu. But now I'm using this object that contains the derivative along every direction in the vector that contains the maximum possible value for G mu nu in that direction. So that's why this is a bound. Very well. Okay, so now let's play. Okay, this is a very nice expression. Now let's play a little bit. Of all these gaps, which is the smallest one? The one with the first excited state, right? And it is at the denominator. So can I upper bound by substituting to all these gaps the smallest one? Yes, right? Because it's at the denominator. So this becomes, let me call it epsilon 1. So this is the gap with the first excited state. and then have the sum over n different from zero of just these objects. And the nice thing is that now this number does not depend on n, so I can pull it outside of the sum. Okay, so now I can do something interesting, because you see, this sum is only on the n different from zero, and it would be very nice if I could sum over all the eigenstates, because then you have a resolution of the identity, all these things that we do in the Hilbert space. However, here I cannot do that, because if I insert also the term n equals zero, then I have a divergence. Well, but now this has been pulled out, so inside here now I can do that. So now what I can do is that I sum over all the n's, so I add the one n equals zero, and I subtract it, so that I have the same thing as before. Do you agree with that? Are you with me? I added and subtracted the same quantity. I could do it because now it's a finite quantity. Okay, and what is this modulus square? It's the product of this by its complex conjugate. So let me do that. And now you see that here I have the sum over n of all the states, all the projectors psi n, which is the identity, is the resolution of the identity. So this becomes, I have this overall quantity, and then I have psi 0 delta h square psi 0 minus psi 0 delta h psi 0 modulus square. What a beautiful expression. Do you recognize it? What is it? It is the fluctuations of delta H. And I lost the sum here, right? I use it to do the resolution of the identity. So you see, the excited states have disappeared. I have an expression that is only in the ground state. And I'm saying that all the matrix elements of my matrix tensor are upper bounded by the fluctuations of my variation of the Hamiltonian in the ground state times the minimum gap. This is really beautiful. And in a second, it will become even more beautiful. Because we want to see under what conditions these things may diverge or converge. So now let's put the second element that we didn't use yet, that our Hamiltonian is local, is the sum of local operators. And therefore, also when I change it a little bit, my perturbation is the sum of local operators. So I is a local part of my lattice. So now let me just plug this inside this expression and find g mu nu is upper bounded by the minimum gap squared, the minus 2. And then I have here the sum over I and j of The expectation value, now this expectation value is understood, are in the ground state. So let spare me writing it. Delta Vi, delta Vj, minus delta Vi, delta Vj. So an upper bound for the matrix elements on my metric is piloted by the inverse gap square with the first excited state and the connected correlation functions of my perturbation, of how much my Hamiltonian changes. Now, if the system has rotational invariance, meaning every direction is the same. So this is Cij, right? What we call Cij. I can just go to, I can take a site and I just look at the distance from that site. So I call it, these connected correlation functions, I call them Cr. And I have the sum over all the distances of these connected correlation functions. No, this is just a radial direction because I used the rotational invariance. Well, then I have L to the D. This is the linear sets of the system times of the dimension of your real space, right? Because I have to sum over all the directions. And then I have my gap. Yes?
This space that we're talking about is the parameter space, right?
No. This is a very good question. Now I'm using the locality of the Hamiltonian. So these operators are local in real space. Are, right, my Hamiltonian, oh, it is making interact these two spins, and my perturbation is making interact these two spins and these two spins and these two spins. So this is, these are correlation functions in real space, not in the parameter space. So this is an upper bound to my metric tensor. Now there is something that I don't know. Is it always true that if I have a gap above the ground state, the correlation functions decay exponentially? Well, we know that when you have symmetry breaking, this is not true, because you can make a superposition, so they do not decay exponentially. Well, in that case, we already know that then you also do not have a gap, right? Because the two states are gapless. Okay, so that is covered. But if you have a unique ground state, is it always true that correlation functions decay exponentially? So we have seen it in some examples. We have seen it in the Ising model. But we would like to have a general theorem that it would be so cool that it is always true that, you know, if you have a mass, propagators decay exponentially. So we don't know yet. This is what we're going to discover next week. But let's use this folk knowledge that this is the case, that this thing always converges if you have a gap. So if you have a gap, then this is upper bounded by this guy, which now is a finite number, right? Because we said there is a gap, L to the D, and the number C, that is whatever is bounding the convergence of this thing. So you see that under this premise that correlation functions always decay exponentially for local quantum systems where there is a gap and a unique ground state, that we're using something that we have always seen. We don't have a theorem yet. Under this very good assumption, then we establish a very general fact that the metric tensor that defines what it means to be similar, et cetera, et cetera, cannot diverge if there is a gap. So that gaplessness is a necessary condition for a quantum phase transition defined in the most general way as a divergence of the metric tensor. Yes?
Do we need the exponential decay property to make that point if we're in a finite system?
Well, as you know, correct. So we saw it with the energy, but it's similar for correlation functions in the first lecture. Then, if you have power law, then it depends on the dimension of the space because it is about how a power law converges when you integrate it on an infinite volume. Plus, when you have a power law, I think I wrote this in the notes, but I didn't say it in the lecture. You also have a problem that these laws also may diverge at short distances, the so-called ultraviolet divergences. And we didn't care about that because in the frame of mind of statistical mechanics, you don't care what happens at short distances. You only care about what happens at large distances when the system is big. So in order to have power laws converge at short distances, as you know from quantum field theory, you need a cutoff, an ultraviolet cutoff. It means, okay, for some reason, the theory, this interaction is only valid up to a very small distance, and then I don't know. It's effective field theory. So whatever I wrote on the blackboard saying, oh, this integral converges for the energy density, it may not converge at very short distances, and somehow I was not caring because you have to imagine that that law doesn't go from zero to R infinity, but it is from some cutoff to R infinity. And our concern was for the extended system. It was the infrared divergence that we were concerned with. However, you will notice that, oh, it is upper bound, but actually it is exploding the thermodynamic limit like L to the D, even if there is not a phase transition. This is an inheritance of this very basic problem that I told you at the beginning, that when you have an infinite tensor product, and you tilt a little bit, very tiny little bit, all the states, and you take the overlap, in the thermodynamic limit, they become orthogonal. So typically, in the infinite tensor product, all unless you do very fancy things like sister algebras, all the distances scale like L to the D, like the volume. So because we are not being too fancy, we just are aware of the problem, but it shows up here. This means that the correct quantity is not the G mu nu, but the rescaled G mu nu. You just divide G mu nu by the volume. It's the density of G mu nu. So strictly speaking, that is what has to diverge in the thermodynamic limit to see a quantum phase transition. I actually do not know if everyone has developed this theory, taking in account things like sister algebras and Feynman algebras so that everything is super clean and these things do not show up and you do not need to rescale. I think nobody has done it. I don't even think it's impossible to do. It's just nobody has done it. Maybe one of you may want to do it, if he's mathematically inclined. Okay. So this is, for now, the end of what we mean by quantum phase transition. So we have given a very interesting definition of what is a quantum phase as a domain of well-behavedness of what it means to change a state. A quantum phase transition is the fact that in some sense the state changes dramatically. And this change of the state is incorporated in this guy. What comes next? First of all, we would really like to understand this assumption better. So what are really the conditions such that all correlation functions decay exponentially? Because then, if this is the case, if we can prove that, so if we prove this implication that if you have a unique ground state and a gap, then correlation functions decay, you still have open the logical possibility that you could have a non-unique ground state and still have correlation functions that decay. If this happens, this is not symmetry breaking. It's a new kind of order. Okay? So we would like to understand the detail of such a theorem that it exists, because that would guide us to understand, oh, maybe this is how I can find another kind of order. So this is what we are set out to discover in next week. First of all, what enters in the fact that correlation functions decay exponentially, and then show a new kind of order. To do that, in passing, we have to learn a mathematical tool called the Lieber-Robinson bounds, of which I will speak Monday, and that by itself has a lot of beautiful implications about what is Lorentz symmetry and in what sense it can be seen as emergent instead of as fundamental. Okay, so see you Monday.